Meditation has to engage not only the thinking part of your mind, but also your emotions. Otherwise, it gets dry and doesn't totally train you. So it's good to think about the emotions that get involved, so that the training can be more complete. The first one you're supposed to bring to the training is Sungwega. That's the emotion that Prince Siddhartha felt on seeing the old person and the sick person and the dead person. Sungwega is one of those words, it doesn't quite have an equivalent in English. It's a sense of shock, dismay, urgency. And it's related to the word Sungwega actually means terror in some of the passages in the canon. It's a really chastened realization about what life is like, that the pleasures you're pursuing are fleeting. They never really provide satisfaction. You look at you yourself, and you're fleeting as well. And the amount of suffering in life, not only is it fleeting, but there's a lot of suffering before you fleet totally. There's that passage where the Buddha says that compared to the tears you've shed in all your many lifetimes, the ocean is smaller, has less water. You've drunk more milk from your mother's breast, whether your mother was human or a dog or whatever, than there is water in the ocean. And Buddha says, just thinking about that should be enough to give you a sense of dismay, a sense of dispassion, to make you want to gain release. Now, taken on its own, Sungwega can be a very depressing realization, which is why it has to be paired with basada, or confidence, the confidence that there is a way out. And that famous story about the young prince seeing the old person and the sick person and the dead person. He also saw a forest mendicant. And the realization after seeing that forest mendicant is, this must be the way out. If there's any way out, this is it. And so he pursued that with a strong sense of clarity, a strong sense of conviction. Ajahn Suwat, when he would lead the meditation here at Metta, would often say, start with a sense of basada, that this is your way out, and stick with the practice with that sense of conviction. Confidence, desire. Because if you approach the meditation in a desultory way, you're going to get desultory results. You really have to be devoted to what you're doing here. Or as Ajahn Phuong would say, you have to be crazy about the meditation if you want to meditate well. You have to learn to get the meditation so that it really engages your imagination. What can be done with the mind as you focus it on the breath? What can be done with the breath? How can you learn to relate to the breath in a way that allows you to settle down and see what's going on in the mind? And when you come up with obstacles, you want to have this sort of inquisitive mind that doesn't just give up in the face of the obstacle, but tries to find a way around, with a conviction that there is a way around. That's what the confidence is there for. If you're lost in the woods and think there's no way out, there's going to be no way out. If you think there's a way out, at least you have a chance of finding it. So when you come up against issues in the meditation, try to use your ingenuity as much as you can. If you find yourself controlling the breath, it's natural that you're going to be controlling the breath. In fact, it's important that you realize that that's happening. Many times they say, well, let the breath come in and out on its own and don't control it. What happens then, though, is that you don't notice how you're controlling it. It all goes underground. What we're doing here is bringing that issue up into the opening. It's okay, as long as you're controlling the breath, try to control it skillfully. And what is it that controls the breath? There's an intention and there's a perception. Can you change your perception of the breath so that the way you control the breath actually does less harm to the breath? What ways of thinking of the breath coming in and out of the body help to overcome the unhealthy or unskillful ways that you control the breath? And what different kinds of breathing energy are there in the body? Look into that as well. Because you find that different kinds of breath energy are helpful at different times. When you've got lower back problems, it's good to think of breath energy coming up from the soles of your feet. Giving more strength to the back as it goes up and then out the top of the head. If there's a tightness in the chest, think of the tightness spreading out through the shoulders and out the arms and out the fingers. In other words, use your ingenuity so that you become more and more interested in staying in the present moment. All too often, we approach concentration practice as an exercise in forcing the mind to stay still, not to think, not to move, not to do anything. And of course, as soon as you tell it not to move, it's going to start fidgeting around like a little kid told to sit still in a chair. But if you give the child something to explore, something to look into, the child can get very still and very enthralled and sit in the chair for hours without complaining. So try to engage your ingenuity as you practice. And always have that conviction that no matter what the problem is in the meditation, there's a way around it. That confidence is what's going to see you through. Of course, simply the confidence is not good enough. You have to start seeing results as well. And when you start seeing them, there will be a sense of ease and finally a sense of rapture as well, a sense of fullness or refreshment. When you finally figured out a way to be with the breath consciously and intentionally and yet allow the breath energy to feel full in every little cell in the body. And how to maintain the right amount of pressure so that you're not squeezing it and not pushing it or pulling it, that it's just right there. Some people experience this as a sensation of drowning. They're so used to breathing in a particular way or having the mind's cartoon idea of what the breathing has to do as it comes in and out of the body, that when they finally give up on that cartoon idea, there's a sense of drowning. Well, sit with that. If the breath is going to come in, it's going to come in. If it's not going to come in, well, don't worry about it. It'll have to come in at some point when it really has to. And allow it not to disturb anything that feels still. And you find there comes a sense of fullness. And with it, a sense of ease. you become a connoisseur of your breathing. You learn to really enjoy it. This amount of enjoyment is a necessary part of the path as well. That's where the image of feeding comes in. The Buddha talks about feeding on rapture, feeding on the ease that comes with the meditation. And as you learn to feed off of that, you start looking at the other things the mind has been feeding on. And realize that it's pretty miserable food. This is where the sense of nibbida comes in. It's sometimes translated as disenchantment, sometimes disgust even, or revulsion. In other words, a sense of having had enough of something and no longer being attracted by it, because you've got better food. And a lot of the preliminary work in discernment is just that, learning how to maintain that sense of stillness, being centered, having a sense of fullness, and learning to adjust it as you need it, learning how to gladden the mind when it needs to be gladdened, how to release the mind when it needs to be released, how to steady it when it needs to be steadied. And every time you catch it slipping off to feed on something else, ask yourself, why are you going there? What good do you get out of that kind of feeding? And a lot of the discernment comes in seeing that the other things you've been feeding on all through your life really are not worth it. You've really got something much better here. And it's only when you've been able to use the concentration as a basis for overcoming passion, especially sensual passion, it's only then that you have to transcend the concentration itself. When your sense of nibbida or disenchantment can then turn to the concentration, because you've discovered something in the mind that doesn't need to feed anymore, even on the pleasure and the rapture, the equanimity of concentration. That's when the sense of nibbida, sense of viraga or dispassion, that's when they become total. And it's when they can liberate the mind. So as you can see, it's a long series of different emotions. The Buddha sometimes talks about the grief and the joy of being on the path. Those get involved as well. The grief is simply the realization that there's a lot of dangers in life and you haven't reached the goal yet, but you learn how to use even that as a spur to your practice. But again, it should be combined with a sense of confidence, conviction, desire, leading to the joy that comes when you can actually see yourself making progress on the path. The mind can settle down more than it used to. It has a greater sense of well-being, of wholeness and fullness than it had before. You can take joy in that. So the path is not just a matter of figuring things out, although that's important. It's a matter also of learning how to marshal these different emotions, some of which are normally regarded as negative. Sangvega, grief, disenchantment, disgust. But they have their uses. And so learn how to cultivate them all along the way. Because without these emotions, the practice doesn't go anywhere. With them, it can take you to release.